February 18th, 1976, Orlando, Florida. 15-year-old Linda Kerr leaves her home in order to walk to her boyfriend's residence, but she never arrives and is subsequently reported missing. Investigators look into the possibility that Linda may have left the area with a biker gang and become an exotic dancer in another city, but this is never officially confirmed. 7 years later, one of Linda's brothers is charged with murdering his sister-in-law, but while there is suspicion that he could have also harmed Linda, no evidence is found to implicate him, and Linda continues to remain a missing person. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I am your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we'll be covering a cold case involving a missing teenage girl, the 1976 disappearance of Linda Kerr. This coming weekend, I'm going to be on Podcast Row attending CrimeCon in Orlando, Florida, and per tradition, whenever I attend one of these podcasting events, I always like to release an episode in which I cover a case from the host city that very same week. So I uncovered a little-known missing persons case from Orlando, which wound up going in some very unexpected directions. Linda Kerr vanished without a trace after leaving her house to walk to her boyfriend's residence, and investigators would eventually receive information that Linda had been seen over 140 miles away in Jacksonville, working as an exotic dancer at a topless bar, known for being frequented by a notorious motorcycle gang. For reasons that are not entirely clear, the Orange County Sheriff's Office seemed to believe that Linda ran away of her own accord, and they closed the investigation, but a shocking event would cause them to reevaluate things years later. In 1982, Linda's sister-in-law, Carol Joy Kerr, who was married to her brother Ken, would be abducted from her home and brutally murdered. The perpetrator was eventually identified as one of Linda's other brothers, Keith, who had an extensive history of making threatening phone calls to women, so naturally, some people wondered if he may have been capable of harming Linda. No evidence has ever been found to indicate that Keith was responsible for Linda's disappearance, but if not, what did actually happen to her? There isn't a ton of available information about this case, so after I'm done discussing Linda's story, I'm going to spend a few moments talking about three other cold cases involving some African-American teenage girls, which happened to take place in Orlando in 1976. They involve a missing girl named Mabel Andrews, an unidentified decedent known as the Orlando Jane Doe, and a deceased victim named Nancy Grace Daniel. And no, she has nothing to do with that other Nancy Grace. While there's no evidence to suggest that any of these three cases are connected to Linda's disappearance, they may very well be connected to each other. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. Also, I just wanted to announce that I'm going to be on vacation for the rest of this month, so next Wednesday, September the 27th, instead of releasing a new episode, we'll be dropping one of our older Patreon bonus episodes into our feed and releasing it to the general public for the first time, and I'll share more details about this at the end of this episode. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the disappearance of Linda Kerr.
Thank you.
Our story begins in Orlando, Florida in 1976, and our central figure is 15-year-old Linda Louise Kerr. Originally born in Washington, D.C., Linda moved to Orlando with her family when she was only 2 years old. She has a total of four brothers and two sisters, and currently lives with her parents, Andrew and Norma Kerr, while attending Boone High School. At around 4 p.m. on February the 18th, Linda left her residence on Dolly Avenue in order to walk to her boyfriend's residence on Aaron Court, three blocks away. However, Linda never arrived there, and when she failed to resurface by the early morning hours of February the 19th, her parents contacted the Orange County Sheriff's Office in order to report her missing. A search effort failed to turn up any trace of Linda, and since she left her purse and her shoes behind at the house, her family did not believe she ran away. Well, 10 days after Linda disappeared, Andrew Kerr received a phone call from an anonymous male who claimed that he had kidnapped Linda and was holding her for ransom. The caller told Andrew that if he delivered $20,000 to a specific location in the unincorporated community of Fellowship, located over 80 miles outside Orlando, Linda would be released within 24 hours. Andrew claimed that he heard a female voice speaking to the phone claiming to be Linda, but he became skeptical that it was actually her. When Andrew asked the male caller to have Linda answer some questions to confirm her identity, such as the names of relatives and details about a scar she had on her right leg, the caller refused to do so. Well, sure enough, the whole ransom demand turned out to be a hoax, and the caller was soon identified as a man named Carl Thomas. He was arrested at his apartment alongside his wife, Judy Thomas, who had presumably impersonated Linda over the phone. Investigators determined that the couple were not involved in Linda's disappearance, as they had simply read about her story in the newspapers and decided to capitalize on the whole situation in order to make some money, so they both wound up being charged with extortion. During the early stages of the investigation, a private investigator hired by the Kerr family told the media that Linda's disappearance may have been connected to a trial which took place 1 year earlier. An unnamed defendant had been charged with solicitation for prostitution, and while Linda had no direct involvement in the trial, two of her female friends had testified against this man, and he was found guilty. The defendant reportedly said that he would get back at the girls who had testified against him, and since he had been released on parole by the time Linda went missing, her family feared that he may have gone after her as retribution. However, the two girls who testified against this man were found safe, and they claim to have no knowledge of Linda's disappearance, so the Orange County Sheriff's Office pretty much discounted the possibility that this trial had any connection to her case. In fact, investigators still seem to lean towards the possibility that Linda took off on her own, but Andrew did not believe this, as she had no prior history of running away or any other disciplinary problems. He felt that if Linda was still alive, she would have at least called home on her mother's birthday, which was March the 27th, just over 1 month after she disappeared. Well, a few months later, an eyewitness would report having seen Linda at a topless bar in Jacksonville, over 140 miles away, where she was working as an exotic dancer and going under the name Dawn. Investigators seemed to believe this witness's account was credible, as her description of Linda/Dawn was apparently quite accurate, and she even described a noticeable scar that Linda had on her right leg. The witness had once been associated with a notorious renegade motorcycle gang known as the Outlaws, who were known for frequenting this particular bar in Jacksonville. According to investigators, there was evidence that Linda had left Orlando with the Outlaws, but they never provided any specific details, and the whole situation is quite murky. Regardless, the Orange County Sheriff's Office decided to close their investigation into Linda's disappearance, and years later, Andrew Kerr would tell the Orlando Sentinel, quote, "We were told by investigators soon after she disappeared that she had moved to Miami and married and didn't want to get in contact with us. That's the last we heard from the investigators about her disappearance. If they knew she was in Miami, they could have told her to just call us and tell us she was all right. They wouldn't even do that," end quote. Well, Linda's case would eventually return to the spotlight after the Kerr family experienced another tragedy. By 1982, Linda's older brother, Ken Kerr, had moved from Orlando to the city of Kissimmee, located 20 miles away, and was living in the Buenaventura Lake subdivision alongside his 28-year-old wife, Carol Joy Kerr. Ken was working with the U.S. Postal Service at Orlando International Airport while Carol had spent the past 8 years employed at Walt Disney World as a boat pilot. On March the 9th, the couple were less than 1 week shy of celebrating their second wedding anniversary and planning to have their first child. However, when Ken returned home from work at around 1 a.m., he was surprised to discover that his wife was not there, even though the door was unlocked, the lights were left on, and Carol's purse was still on the coffee table. Ken noticed that Carol's car was now parked in the driveway at a neighbor's residence, but when he went over to the house to look for her, no one answered the front door. Since his neighbor had a history of heart trouble, Ken assumed that Carol may have taken him to a hospital in the neighbor's car, but even though he called a couple of local hospitals to see if Carol might be there, no one had seen her. Ken decided he was going to wait up for his wife until she returned home, but he wound up falling asleep on the couch. When morning hit and Ken woke up and saw that Carol was still not there, he went to check her car again in the neighbor's driveway, and this time, he noticed that the vehicle's front seat upholstery and padding had been ripped out. Ken also finally spoke to the neighbor, who confirmed that he hadn't seen Carol and had no idea why her car was parked there. After Ken contacted Carol's father, Bob Harker, the two men started searching the subdivision for her. While checking through a wooded area located near the subdivision's entrance, they wound up coming across some scraps of blood-stained tissue paper, as well as pieces of seat padding from Carol's car. After following a trail of bloodstains on the ground, Ken and Bob discovered a shallow grave containing Carol's body, so the Osceola County Sheriff's Office were summoned to the scene. It turned out that Carol had been shot once in the head with a .357 caliber bullet and was also stabbed several times before her body was wrapped in a piece of upholstery from her car and buried in the grave. The crime left everyone completely baffled, as Carol was considered to be a very nice person with no known enemies, and since she was not sexually assaulted and nothing appeared to have been robbed or stolen from her home, no one could figure out the motive for the murder. There were no signs of a struggle at Carol's residence, and since the physical evidence indicated that she was shot in the passenger seat of her own car, investigators leaned towards the possibility that she was killed by someone she knew. Ken responded to the tragedy by immediately selling his home and moving into a condo in Orlando, and he would later get remarried. For over a year, the Osceola County Sheriff's Office had no luck uncovering any promising leads or suspects, and one investigator would refer to the crime as the strangest case he had ever worked on. But on April the 29th, 1983, things would go in a very unexpected direction when Ken's 25-year-old brother, Keith Barton Kerr, was arrested and charged with Carol's murder. Keith had been a pallbearer at Carol's funeral and had since gotten married to Carol's best friend, but according to the sheriff's office, Keith was never considered to be a suspect until 2 weeks before his arrest, and he wound up appearing on the radar because of an unrelated investigation. Over the previous year, at least 40 women had reported receiving a series of harassing phone calls from an anonymous male who threatened to murder them and described how he was going to rip out their hearts and blow their brains out. Complaints about these calls first started pouring in only a few weeks after Carol's death, but while they came to a temporary halt for several months, they would start up again by the winter of 1982. Well, much like Carol, many of the women who received the calls were employees at Walt Disney World, and the graphic details the caller shared about how he was planning to murder them were strikingly similar to the circumstances of how Carol was killed. Things eventually reached the point where some of the women believed they recognized Keith's voice, and it turned out that he had a personal connection to many of them, such as them being acquaintances of his wife or employees at the bank where Keith cashed his paychecks. Investigators finally started looking at Keith as a potential suspect in Carol's murder, and since he had previously served in the army, they were able to obtain his fingerprints and compare them with the prints found in Carol's car. When they turned out to be a match, Keith was subsequently charged with the crime. Well, Keith's arrest caused Linda's disappearance to finally return to the spotlight as a new set of investigators agreed to reopen her case. Given Keith's capacity for violence, they wanted to explore the possibility that he might have been capable of harming his younger sister, but no evidence could be found to indicate that Keith was responsible for causing Linda to go missing. While the original plan was to take Keith to trial for first-degree murder, there were potential issues with the evidence against him. Even though Keith's fingerprints were found inside Carol's car and her residence, the prosecution feared that the defense might be able to generate reasonable doubt since Keith had been inside the car and the house on previous occasions prior to her murder. A print belonging to Keith was found on one of the car's doors, which appeared to have been made in watered-down blood, but crime scene analysts couldn't conclusively verify that. So in March of 1984, both sides reached a plea agreement in which Keith would plead guilty to second-degree murder. While a first-degree murder conviction would mean a sentence of life imprisonment with no possibility of parole for 25 years, a guilty plea to second-degree murder allowed Keith to receive a sentence of life imprisonment with the possibility of parole after serving only 5 years. In September of 1989, a hearing was held in front of the State Parole Commission to determine if Keith was fit to re-enter society. Keith's parents claimed that he was on drugs at the time he killed Carol and was very remorseful for what he had done, and produced a report from a state parole examiner who had interviewed Keith and believed he should be released from prison in 1995. However, since Carol had been their only child, her parents, Bob and Ruth Harker, expressed their belief that Keith should remain in prison for the rest of his life. The Harkers also produced letters which had been written by some of the other women Keith had threatened during his phone calls, who feared that Keith might attempt to harm them if he went free. Well, in the end, the Parole Commission agreed with the Harkers and recommended that Keith remain in prison until at least 2051. Keith continues to remain incarcerated to this day and will not be eligible for release until he's 94 years old. Sadly, Andrew Kerr passed away in September of 2006, while Norma Kerr followed suit just over 1 year later in January of 2008. If you search Norma's obituary online, you'll see that she is still listed as being survived by all 7 of her children, including Linda, so it does not appear that Linda has ever been declared legally dead. But after 47 years, there's still no conclusive answers about what happened to her. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So I only recently became familiar with this story while I was searching for an Orlando cold case to cover this week, and I definitely wish there was more information available, as I'm sure that additional details might offer some helpful context about this whole situation. I mean, you can only imagine what a horrible experience this must have been for Andrew and Norma Kerr, as within the span of 7 years, they had a daughter go missing, a daughter-in-law get murdered, and one of their sons get charged and receive a sentence of life imprisonment for the murder. Obviously, Andrew and Norma tried really hard to convince the State Parole Commission that Keith was worthy of receiving a second chance, but Carol's parents felt much differently. When Keith's parole situation made the news back in 1989, the Orlando Sentinel tried to reach Ken Kerr for comment, but he declined the request for an interview. It would not surprise me at all if Ken felt much differently than his parents about allowing the man who murdered his wife to go free, even if Keith was his own brother. I would be really interested in knowing a lot more about these family dynamics, because even though we know the circumstances of how Keith killed Carol, none of the sources I found provide any real explanation for his motive. I know very little about Keith's background, but prior to the murder, were there any noticeable warning signs with him to suggest he was capable of something like this? It's obvious that Keith was a very disturbed person, since he made threatening phone calls to at least 40 women, where he went into graphic detail about how he was planning to kill them. But did anyone ever see this side of Keith before Carol's murder took place? If you look through the earliest media coverage of this case, law enforcement was initially completely perplexed by the crime, since Carol had no known enemies, and they did not appear to have any strong suspects until they realized that it was Keith making all the harassing phone calls to the other women. It sounds like these calls started in the weeks following Carol's death, but I'm not sure if Keith had a history of doing stuff like this beforehand, so perhaps this was the result of some sort of subconscious guilt or desire to be caught. If he hadn't made the calls, I'm not sure he ever would have popped up on the radar as a suspect. Carol was not sexually assaulted, and there were no signs of a struggle at her residence, so I have to assume that Keith showed up there and somehow convinced Carol to climb into her car with him until he shot her in the head. But again, I have no idea what his motive was. Did he want to go through the act of killing someone just to see what it was like? The main reason I'm focusing so much on this is because you have to wonder if Carol's murder was the first time Keith ever did something like this, or could he have been capable of harming his sister Linda 6 years earlier? Naturally, after Keith was charged with murder, investigators did attempt to see if they could link him to Linda's disappearance, but it's worth reiterating that they never found any evidence to suggest he may have been involved, so the whole thing might be nothing more than a tragic coincidence. However, since there is virtually no evidence to work with in Linda's case at all, I can see why the possibility of Keith's involvement cannot be completely ruled out. At the time Linda went missing, Keith would have been 18 years old, which is definitely an age when one would be capable of committing murder, but the issue is that we don't have any information about his whereabouts in February of 1976, or if he was even still living at home with Linda and their parents at that time. I know that Keith once served in the army, so if he was already enlisted and nowhere near Orlando when his sister disappeared, then you can safely rule him out as a suspect, and all this speculation is completely moot. But here's what we do know. Linda left her home in order to walk to her boyfriend's residence, and even though it was only about 3 blocks away, Linda never arrived, so something obviously happened during this narrow window of time. While researching this story, I was struck by the number of parallels which could be made to another missing persons case involving a teenage girl which took place in Florida during the 1970s and also happened to be covered on episode number 150 of The Trail Went Cold. Of course, I'm referring to the unsolved disappearance of 17-year-old Amy Billig, which occurred on March the 5th, 1974 in Coconut Grove, which is about 240 miles southeast of Orlando. Much like Linda, Amy vanished without a trace after she left her home and failed to arrive at her intended destination, and in both these cases, the victim's parents received a ransom demand which turned out to be a hoax, orchestrated by opportunists who read about the disappearance in the newspapers and decided to capitalize on the publicity by attempting to extort money from the family. But even though these extortionists were caught and punished for what they did, investigators determined that they had no actual involvement in the disappearances. But the most striking parallel between Amy Billig and Linda Kerr is the alleged involvement of the Outlaws motorcycle gang. As you might recall, Amy's mother, Sue Billig, received information that her daughter had been kidnapped by the Outlaws and was being sold and passed around like a piece of property by various bikers. Sue spent years pursuing this lead in hopes that Amy might still be alive somewhere, but even though she was fed a lot of unsubstantiated rumors, she never found any conclusive proof that Amy had been with a biker gang, and the whole thing may have been nothing more than a wild goose chase. Well, in Linda's case, the Orange County Sheriff's Office heard from a witness who was once affiliated with the Outlaws, and claimed that she saw Linda dancing at a topless bar in Jacksonville under the name Dawn. This bar was often frequented by the Outlaws, and the Sheriff's Office apparently said there was evidence that Linda had left Orlando with members of the gang voluntarily, but they never provided any further details and pretty much closed the investigation for over 6 years until Keith was arrested for Carol's murder. Now, I've stated this on the podcast so many times that I must sound like a broken record, but during the 1970s, it was fairly common for law enforcement to write missing teenagers off as runaways if there was no direct evidence of foul play. But in Linda's case, what evidence did they have that she left voluntarily, aside from one eyewitness who thought she saw her at the topless bar in Jacksonville? They put a lot of credence in the fact that Dawn apparently had a scar on her right leg, which was very similar to Linda's, but how could investigators have been certain that the witness was not mistaken? I mean, I'm sure Linda was not the only young woman living in the state of Florida at that time who had a scar on her right leg. However, for the sake of argument, let's just assume that the witness was correct and Dawn was actually Linda. She was only 15 years old when she went missing, and shouldn't it be, you know, illegal for someone that young to be dancing topless at a bar? Given that the Outlaws were a renegade biker gang who were involved in criminal activity and known for treating women like property, how could investigators have been so certain that Linda left with them voluntarily and was not abducted against her will? Did Orange County not bother to send anyone to this bar in Jacksonville to find Dawn and interview her and verify her identity? And then we have these odd comments from Andrew Kerr about how the sheriff's office told him that Linda had moved to Miami and got married, but no longer wanted to have any contact with her family. I'd really be curious to know where that information came from, since Miami is located about 350 miles southeast of Jacksonville, so doesn't this contradict the whole Don sighting? Without any more specific details, I can't say for certain what actually happened here, but it sounds to me like we have a law enforcement agency which did not want to invest a lot of time and resources trying to find a missing girl. So when they received information that she ran away and was still alive somewhere, they used that as an excuse to close the investigation, even though they may not have actually gone to the trouble of verifying that this information was true. Whatever the case, it sounds like there were new investigators working for the Orange County Sheriff's Office in 1983, which is why they agreed to take a fresh look at Linda's disappearance after Keith was charged with murder. But unfortunately, by this point, 7 years had passed, so who knows how much crucial time or evidence might have been lost. The only other potential theory which was pushed during the early stages of the investigation was that Linda's disappearance may have been connected to a trial in which some of her friends had testified against a suspect and helped him get convicted on the charge of solicitation for prostitution. Once again, I can't really jump to any conclusions without further information about the situation, but even though this guy apparently swore revenge on these girls for their testimony, I really don't see why he would target Linda, who had no involvement in this trial at all. Since Linda's friends were never actually harmed, I think this angle is probably a dead end. So without anything further to go on, I think we have to circle back and once again talk about Keith as a potential suspect. Once again, we don't know anything about possible motives or if Keith would have even had the opportunity to harm his sister on the day she disappeared, but given how he handled his cover-up of Carol's murder, my gut instinct tells me that this was the first time he had ever committed a crime like that. To recap, after shooting Carol inside her car, wrapping her body in the upholstery, and burying her in a shallow grave, he then returned the car to the driveway next to Carol's residence, even though there was a risk of him being seen by the neighbors. He also did an incredibly sloppy job of burying Carol's body, since Ken and Bob were able to find her almost immediately when performing a search of the woods the following morning. So I have a hard time reconciling the idea that the same person who did this could have murdered Linda when he was only 18 years old and did such a thorough job of disposing her body that no trace of her has been found for nearly 5 decades. I have a feeling that Carol's murder was just another tragedy which hit the Kerr family and had no connection to what happened to Linda. But if Keith did not harm Linda, was she the victim of foul play from another individual, or did she actually run away on her own? Well, with the information I have now, I am inclined to believe that Linda did not run away, and even if she was the mysterious Dawn and wound up dancing at a bar in Jacksonville alongside the outlaws, she was probably forced to do this against her will. But I do think there's a chance that Linda was the victim of a random stranger who saw her walking alone down the street and decided to take advantage of the situation by abducting and murdering her without anybody seeing anything. Even though Carol's murder compelled investigators to take a fresh look at Linda's disappearance in 1983, I don't get the sense that they uncovered any new leads, and I haven't seen any real media coverage about Linda in 4 decades. I'm not sure if anyone is actively investigating this case anymore, but it's important for podcasts like this to keep the memories of these victims alive and ensure they are not forgotten. So if you happen to have any information about the disappearance of Linda Kerr, please contact the Orange County Sheriff's Office at 407-254-7200. That's 407-254-7200. Now, I mentioned in the intro that I was going to take a quick look at some other cold cases involving teenage girls which took place in Orlando in 1976, and while I'm not saying that Linda's case is connected to any of them, I think the idea is worth exploring. So on January the 21st, 1977, just under 1 year after Linda went missing, a county worker and his crew were working on the southwest shore of Lake Mann in an unincorporated area just outside Orlando when the worker came across some partial skeletal remains submerged in a small amount of water in a canal surrounded by high weeds. When the authorities were summoned to the scene, they soon determined that the remains belonged to a young African-American female estimated to be between 17 to 20 years old, between 5'2 and 5'8, and around 110 to 130 pounds. Some clothing was found near her remains, including a size 5 or size 6 pair of blue jean-like pants, a yellow and brown, earth-toned, size 32 blouse with a beach scene, flowers, and pictures of people printed on the front, pastel-colored underwear with a floral pattern, a bra, and a left blue flip-flop. A silver bracelet with a blue stone was also found in the water. The most distinct features on the victim were a lower nose asymmetry, in which the right side was higher than the left, and she also had an oval defect on her left ankle. The victim's exact cause of death could not be determined, though she was believed to have been deceased at least 4 months before she was discovered. Since she could not be identified, she simply became known as Orlando Jane Doe. Well, believe it or not, just 2 months later, on March the 12th, the partial skeletal remains of another victim would be found at Lake Mann, this time by a group of hunters who came across them on a southwest residential shore with dense undergrowth not too far from where the first victim had been found. Like Orlando Jane Doe, the victim was determined to be a young African-American female estimated to be between 13 to 17 years old and between 5'2" and 5'5". Traces of braided hair were on her skull, and the only clothing that could be found at the scene was a bra and knit-style bikini underwear, as well as a gold-colored pierced earring and a gold-colored ring with an adjustable band and the word love inscribed on it. Much like the first victim, this girl's exact cause of death could not be determined, though she was believed to have been dead at least 4 to 6 months prior to discovery. Both these sets of remains were found fairly close to Orlando's predominantly black Paramore neighborhood, but even though there was speculation that their deaths might be connected, there was virtually no evidence to work with, and the victims would remain unidentified for decades. Well, on June the 27th, 2014, a press conference was held by the Orange County Sheriff's Office to announce that the second Jane Doe had officially been identified as Nancy Grace Daniel, who had once lived in the Paramore neighborhood. The previous year, the case had been reopened by a pair of retired detectives who volunteered their time to work with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They soon learned that 14-year-old Nancy Grace Daniel had officially been reported missing to the Orlando Police Department 6 months before the discovery of the second Jane Doe and was last seen at a location only 4 miles away from Lake Mann. However, since the investigation into Nancy's case was being handled by the Orlando PD and the investigation into the Jane Doe was under the jurisdiction of the Orange County Sheriff's Office, no one had ever put two and two together. After a DNA sample was collected from Nancy's brother and compared to the remains of the victim, a positive identification was made. At around 12:30 a.m. on September the 6th, 1976, Nancy and her cousin, Eugenia Oliver, left the Wooden Nickel, a game room located near the corners of Paramore Avenue and Anderson Street. Eugenia said that Nancy had gotten way ahead of her, and she last saw her cousin speaking to an unidentified person inside a red car with a black top. She then saw Nancy climb into the car and figured that she had just gotten tired and was getting a ride home, but this was the last time Nancy was confirmed to be alive, and the driver of the car was never identified. Even though Nancy was officially reported missing, the initial investigation failed to turn up any leads, and it would be nearly 38 years before her family finally learned what happened to her. The media coverage surrounding Nancy's identification also brought the story of the Orlando Jane Doe back into the spotlight, as there was hope that this newfound publicity might lead to her being identified as well. However, this is yet to take place, and there are still no conclusive answers about how Nancy and the Jane Doe were killed, and if the same person might have been responsible for both of their deaths. But we know Nancy went missing in September of 1976, and since Orlando Jane Doe was found in January of 1977 and was estimated to have been dead for 4 months at that point, the math shows that the two victims were likely killed during the same time period. And I personally think that it's too much of a coincidence that they were both found in such close proximity to each other on the shores of Lake Mann. But before I talk any more about this, I need to discuss the disappearance of another African-American teenage girl from Orlando named Mabel Andrews. Most of the sources you'll find out there list Mabel's date of disappearance as January the 16th, 1976, but that might not be accurate, and this is probably one of the most frustrating examples I've ever seen of conflicting information in a missing persons case. If you read Mabel's profile page at the Charlie Project and the other missing persons websites, It states that she was last seen near America Court, and she often walked from the Bruton Boulevard and Columbia Street area to the Paramore neighborhood where her grandmother lived. Well, in November of 2013, Mabel's brother, Tommy Lee Andrews, petitioned to have his sister declared legally deceased, but the trial court denied the petition since they felt that the evidence was insufficient to prove she was dead. Tommy then filed an appeal with the Florida District Court of Appeal, but they wound up denying it, and you can find a record of their decision online. But the problem is this document states that Mabel went missing on Christmas Eve in 1974 after leaving her family's home to go to a neighborhood park. To make things even more confusing, if you search hard enough online, you'll find an official report from the Orlando Police Department which states that Mabel had gone missing on Christmas Eve in 1975, and the last known sighting of her was when she was recovered by the Orlando PD on January the 16th, 1976. So was she recovered on that date and subsequently went missing again? It's a very confusing situation, and I have a feeling that someone made a typo somewhere when writing down the exact year Mabel went missing. I bring this up because if you search online discussions about Mabel's disappearance on places like Reddit and WebSleuths, you'll find quite a few posters who think she's a logical candidate to be the Orlando Jane Doe. In fact, some of them have said that they submitted this tip to law enforcement years ago, but even though it's been confirmed that Mabel's DNA is on file, it's unclear if any attempt at a comparison has ever been made. Now, if Mabel actually went missing on Christmas Eve in 1974, then I think that decreases the chances of her being the Jane Doe, since she was believed to have only been deceased 4 months when she was found in January of 1977. But if Mabel did vanish in January of 1976, then I could give them a bit more leeway on being wrong about the estimated time of death. So regardless of whether or not Mabel was the Jane Doe, I don't discount the idea that there could have been a serial killer preying on black girls in Orlando in 1976. And while there is some dispute about the accuracy of the information surrounding Mabel's disappearance, if she really did go missing near the intersection of Bruton Boulevard and Columbia Street, well, that's pretty close to the southern shores of Lake Mann, where the remains of Nancy and the Orlando Jane Doe were found. Now, since Linda Kerr was white and lived in a different section of Orlando, I'm not going to assume that her case is connected to any of these others, but anything is possible. But here's an interesting parallel between Linda's case and Mabel's case, which is nothing more than a coincidence, but fascinating nonetheless. I just mentioned that Mabel's brother, Tommy Lee Andrews, filed a petition to have her declared dead in 2013, but Tommy is quite infamous for being a serial rapist who made legal history when he became the first American to ever be convicted in a court of law as a result of DNA evidence. In February of 1987, Tommy broke into a woman's home in Orlando and raped her at knife point, but when DNA samples were taken from semen left at the crime scene and compared to Tommy's blood samples, they turned out to be a genetic match and led to him being convicted at trial. By the time Tommy filed his petition to have his sister declared dead, he had finished serving his prison sentence and was living in a treatment facility for sex offenders. Now, much like the situation with Linda and Keith Kerr, I'm not going to take Tommy's history of sexual violence as evidence that he could have been responsible for Mabel's disappearance, but I find it to be an astounding coincidence that two completely unconnected teenage girls who went missing within 1 month of each other in Orlando in 1976 would both have brothers that would go on to serve lengthy prison sentences for violent offenses. So getting back to the Orlando Jane Doe, if she is not Mabel Andrews, then I do hope her case will be taken on by an organization such as the DNA Doe Project or Othram Incorporated, so they can use genetic genealogy in order to determine her identity. For all we know, all four of these cold cases that I profiled may be completely unrelated to each other, but that doesn't change the fact that we have a number of different victims from Orlando who all happened to go missing or were murdered within 1 year of each other, and they all deserve justice. Anyway, much like Linda Kerr's disappearance, the cases of Nancy Grace Daniel and the Orlando Jane Doe are being handled by the Orange County Sheriff's Office, so if you happen to have any information about these cases, please contact them at 407-254-7200. Mabel Andrews' disappearance is being handled by the Orlando Police Department, so if you have any information about her case, please contact them at 407-246-7200. 407-246-3950. That's 407-246-3950. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened in any of today's featured cases, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives. This past month, I released an episode titled The Lost Heirs of Unsolved Mysteries, which explores a couple of cases from the show about mysterious individuals who left a substantial amount of money behind when they passed away, so the authorities were attempting to track down any rightful heirs who were entitled to inherit the decedent's estate. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the unexplained 1995 death of Devin Williams. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 50 of those commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Megan D., Daria J., and Christopher M. Thank you all so much for your support. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So like I mentioned during the intro, I'm going to be on vacation for 2 weeks, so next Wednesday, instead of releasing a brand new episode, we'll be dropping one of our Patreon-exclusive bonus episodes into our feed. I originally put together this episode nearly 4 years ago, and it's a more humorous, lighthearted topic than usual, as I'll be discussing my top 10 biggest guilty pleasures from Unsolved Mysteries. In other words, I'll be counting down some of my favorite, sillier segments which were featured on the show, which I still find to be entertaining. So I hope you enjoy this bonus episode, and have yourself a great 2 weeks, and be sure to join us again on Wednesday, October the 4th, when we release our next brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.